Sudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sri Sri Gaunatai Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Srimati Radharani Ki Jai. Okay. Radha Samukha Samsaktim Saki Sangam Nivasanim Twamaham Satatam Bande Madhavasraya Vigraham. Our spiritual master, I continually offer my obeisances unto you, who are always in the presence of Srimati Radharani and are very much devoted to her. You always reside in the association of her confidants, the gopis, and you are the abode of loving devotion to Krishna. So that's a nice invocation, opening prayer. That it's by the mercy of our spiritual master that we get the chance to understand about who Radha and Krishna are, and especially in our line, Gaudiya Vaishnava line, we have this special and unique opportunity to enter into at least a little something taste of their transcendental pastimes. Not that we can understand Radharani, that's not possible. Even Krishna appeared as Lord Chaitanya because he couldn't understand different aspects of Radharani's relationship with himself. So there's no chance of anybody understanding Radharani. Even Krishna has to struggle to do that. So we're not attempting to claim that we know anything about Srimati Radharani. We have to just appreciate some of the pastimes, and we have to hear about those pastimes in the proper way through the disciplic succession. And in that way, hopefully, somehow or another, we can invoke the mercy of Srimati Radharani and be accepted ultimately into the transcendental pastimes of Braj, which is our aim ultimately as devotees. So that's just a little invocation. I want to say something first of all about the observance of transcendental appearance days or disappearance days and different activities. Because from a historical point of view, because we're living in this material world, but these activities, as it's pointed out in the Prema Vivarta, the activities of, say, Radha and Krishna appearing, we think, 5,000 years ago, and then, of course, the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as the combination of the two 500 years ago sounds like a chronological order, that there has to be Radha and Krishna first and then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes after that. But he points out that that's a mistake, actually, to think in that way. There is no chronology and there is no time sequence when you're talking about transcendental pastimes. All the pastimes exist simultaneously on the spiritual platform. But at the same time, we say time, Krishna also says, Sakalena he mahata yoga nashta parantapa. The science of the relationship with the Supreme is actually lost due to the flow of time. So we have to balance the two out. There's the transcendental timeless realm, and then there's this limited material realm which is ruled by time. And somehow or another, we have to figure out a fit for the two. So at least as far as from our perspective is, tiny living beings in this material world, everything is ruled by time, and things do tend to have a chronology. And so time is important in the sense that if we want to preserve the memory of the different activities of the Lord and the appearance days of the Lord, we have to make specific effort to do that. In the spiritual world, there's no effort. Everybody's fully surrendered to Krishna and is swept up in the ebb and flow of different kinds of moods and rasas. But in the material world, we have to make an effort to preserve our memory of the Lord and his appearances and his activities. There's some interesting there's an interesting calculation that was done. I think I mentioned this before, but I'm going to say it again. By a Christian mathematician. His name was John Craig. So John Craig, he was a friend of Sir Isaac Newton. He wrote a book or a small treatise, Christianae Theologiae Principia Mathematica. That was published in 1698. And what it was an attempt through probability theory to calculate the probability of Jesus' existence, his appearance and his existence. What's the chances that he actually exists, in other words. So he had a formula using four different components. One of them was just the number of first-hand primary witnesses. Somebody comes along, is a great personality. Some people had the privilege of being with that personality and witnessing all the events. So there has to be some primary witnesses. Then the next calculation is, then what about the transmission of what they've seen and understood to secondary witnesses, people that weren't directly involved but knew the people that were involved, secondary witnesses. So the transmission of the knowledge through those secondary witnesses. Then the third one depends on elapsed time, how long it is from the event. And then the fourth criteria is the spatial distance. Yeah, because things spread out, as they get spread, it's like butter on bread, it gets thinner and thinner. So in the same way, in the area where the person appeared, then that may be, you know, well preserved. But the further away you get, then the more chance there is of interpolation and forgetfulness coming in. So he calculated, using this probability of these four factors, that by the year 3150, the probability of Jesus' existence would be zero. So that's already 2,000 years past. So he's estimating that in another 1,000 years, nobody will have even heard of Jesus at all. Or if they have, nobody will take any notice of him whatsoever. So we're already 5,000 years since Krishna's appearance, since Radharani's appearance. And we seem to be going strong because we're working on the transcendental platform. So that's a little different from, you know, some mundane exchange or mundane religious principle. At the same time, again, the word time is there, we should know that not everybody, and in fact very few people nowadays, actually believe in Krishna. This is a quote from a Nobel laureate, Dr. Amartya Sen. He was addressing a congress, he was addressing the Indian History Congress. This is a congress especially about Indian history. Yeah, and this was just in 2001, so it's not very long ago. So this fellow, he made the claim, because, you know, when we think of Indian history, we automatically think about the Vedas. We think about the Mahabharata, we think about the Ramayana. These are the Puranas, these are the Itihasas. These are the histories of India, we think. But actually nowadays in India, most people don't think like that. And this rascal is one typical example where he says that, in addressing the delegates, that the Ramayana and Mahabharata do not have any historical value. This is a Nobel laureate speaking. These two epics are simply mythology and nothing but a poet's fancy. He also said that neither Ram nor Krishna was a historical personality. So there you have it. This is one of the top guys in the country, in the Punya Bhumi, the land of religion, the place of Vrindavan, the place of millions of temples. And he's openly declaring there's no such person as Ram, there's no such person as Krishna. These things never happened. It's just some concoction, some guy living in the forest. You know, living on leaves, he must have been, you know, nutritionally deprived of something. And so his brain, you know, concocted these poems about these personalities. Similarly, another great leader of Indian society, Gandhi, he wrote two commentaries on the Srimad Bhagavad Gita. One was called Anashakti Yoga, and the other one's called Gita Bodha. And he says in that book there, the Anashakti Yoga, that generally the Mahabharata is taken to be a historical work. But in my opinion, it is not so. I cannot say that the Ramayana and Mahabharata are historical works. They are simply religious works, as if religion is devoid of any real value and truth. If you were still inclined to treat them as historical works, then I would say they are nothing but the history of the self. In other words, it's just a metaphor for something else, the existential condition of the soul in the material world. They do not contain what happened thousands of years ago. So there you have it, a Nobel laureate and the founding father of modern India, both denying the actual reality of the existence of Krishna, Ram, Radharani, all their associates, etc., etc. So we have to be very, very careful then about, you know, preserving the reality of these histories. We don't talk about them as poetical, you know, concoctions, but rather Radharani actually appeared. There's just one other quote that I want to go to. So we see even 500 years ago, yeah, because when we think about Vrindavan, those of us that have been on, you know, the Braj Mandala Parikrama, you can spend 1 month walking around the whole area, seeing all every day a different place where Krishna had his pastimes. And we take it for granted, you know, these are historical places. Yeah, but actually, up to before 500 years ago, a lot of the remembrance and identification of the places of these pastimes had gone. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to Vrindavan, there were some places, there were some deities that were still there, but they were kind of like locally worshipped. It certainly wasn't a place of pilgrimage so much. Many of the places, important places, had been lost. So you get the description that when he inquired from a local Brahmana who was a tour guide, taking him around the different places, where is Radhakund, he couldn't say. He'd actually not heard of it. And so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he had to look for him on his own. And then because, of course, he's on the transcendental platform, he could understand where Radhakund and Shyamakund actually were. He walked out in the middle of some fields. There was a couple of puddles of water. And he said, "This is Radhakund." Immediately jumped in and took his bath there. And the locals couldn't figure out what this madman is doing. He's bathing in a puddle of water in the middle of the paddy fields. Yeah. But now, of course, if you go to Radhakund, you'll see the, you know, place is very well developed. That's due to the efforts of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu through his immediate disciples or followers, the six Goswamis and others. That was one of the things that they were deputed to do, was to find out where these lost places were and revive them. Because that solidifies what we hear in Shastra. Yeah, we hear stories. We hear pastimes, Ramayana, Mahabharata, and other books. But unless we see the actual artifacts, unless we see the actual places where these events took place, immediately there's a doubt. Oh, Krishna appeared 5,000 years ago in Vrindavan. Oh, where is Vrindavan? Oh, well, we don't know. Somewhere. Immediately there's a doubt. Then it makes you question, yeah, all the rest of what's written there. But if you can actually visit the place where the events took, were manifested, that, you know, shores up our belief, if you like, it shores up our conviction that such a person actually existed and that they actually did the things that are mentioned in the Shastra. Otherwise, it all becomes fairy stories in a very short period of time. So we see that in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, then Vrindavan had almost become lost. Not completely, but the main import of it, the importance of it, was not really properly understood, and it had to be revived. In a similar way, as Krishna's pastimes and places of Leela were, you know, gradually receding into the realm of mythology and fairy stories, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, although it's only 500 years ago, we don't have a problem handling 500 years. Or do we? 5,000 years, we tend to think, yeah, that's such a long time ago, you can't even conceive of it, really. But 500 years ago is not so bad. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you can trace out different events, you know, political events and national events that, you know, take you back to the actual situation where when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was born. But we see also that many of the places of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's activities and pastimes were also lost. Immediately after he left, then the Ganges covered over the area where he was born for 100 years. And in 100 years you forget everything, practically speaking. You can forget everything. And therefore there had to be some similar attempt as the six Goswamis made for reviving the holy places in Vrindavan. Then Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and his followers, Srila Prabhupada, and now handing down to us, some effort had to be made to revive those places, to help to shore up the reality of the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the credibility of his teachings. So it's a very important work to revive these places of pilgrimage. And there's a quote here from the Chaitanya Charitamrita from Anjalila, chapter 14, verse 7, where it's mentioned that Swarup Damodar Goswami and Raghunath Das Goswami witnessed the Chaitanya witnessed Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's activities firsthand, primary witness. And they recorded them in 2 notebooks. This is the transmission. Yeah? And therefore, without reference to these notebooks, one cannot understand the activities of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Very important statement, that unless there's evidences, there's some primary witnesses, and then they take the time and trouble to record everything, and then they pass it on to the secondary witnesses, the likelihood that this is all true, or that you can understand, you know, the teachings and activities, it would very much greatly reduced. So Krishnadas Kaviraj goes on to say that in those days, Swarup Damodar and Raghunath Das Goswami lived with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, whereas all other commentators lived far away from him. In his purport, Prabhupada makes this comment that besides Swarup Damodar and Raghunath Das Goswami, there were also many others who also recorded Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's activities. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur believes that the people of the world would benefit greatly if such notes were available. It is a most unfortunate situation for human society that none of these notebooks is still extant. So that's our situation, that since the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the same business is going on. By the influence of time, everything deteriorates. Human memory is kind of pegged to physical manifestation. As there's no physical manifestation, then your memory goes very, very quickly. And even if there is a physical manifestation, you're still liable to make mistakes in understanding what was going on in those particular places. But at least if you have some primary evidence, you have some first-hand witnesses, and they take the trouble to pass things on to the secondary and third generation, fourth generation, fifth generation, like that, then, you know, within one generation, everything can be lost. Just like the Muslims, when they invaded different places, one of the first things that they would do is destroy the libraries. The communists also, in China, in Russia, that was the first business. If you want to change a person's opinion and sense of identity, self, then the first thing you do is to wipe out his connection with his history. Yeah, because whatever we are, we tend to measure it back you know, through the phases of time. So if you can cut off a person from his own history, then you can then fill their brains up with something new. So the communists knew that, get rid of Confucius and all the other great philosophers, because they're holding us back. This is the, you know, this is the cry in India also, forget the past. This is, you know, ancient stuff. This is sentimentality. It has nothing to do with real knowledge, you know, religious poetic tripe. That's holding us back. It's preventing us from advancing because we're too rooted in the past. So stop teaching Sanskrit, because of course that was the medium language through which all these philosophies and events were portrayed. Cut people off, stop them from learning, you know, their original languages, cut them off from their original traditions, come in and convince them that there is something better, what you had was very inferior, now reject it. So we see that's going on in this Amartya Sen, Gandhi, they were all victims of that. Gandhi himself admitted that unless we become like the British, we won't make any advancement. Yeah, that was one of his statements. And of course his followers, although they make a show of preserving some of the things, there were some things that he stood for which were okay, but nothing spiritual. That was the problem. So we have a great responsibility in ISKCON to revive the credibility of these histories. Yeah. We have a responsibility, which Prabhupada is expressing his responsibility by building the temple of the Vedic planetarium. That, as he said, is his contribution to the work that was begun by Bhaktivinoda Thakur when he found the original place of Lord Chaitanya's birth and appearance. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, of course, he built that temple there at the Yog Pit. And then after him, so many other temples have come up. But Prabhupada's particular contribution is this temple of the Vedic planetarium, not just as a monument, but as a place of learning. He wanted the two to be there together. You build a monument that gives some conviction about the reality of, you know, the events that took place in that area. But without any transmission of knowledge, that monument also just becomes a heap of bricks and stone, that's all. Yeah, it doesn't have any real significance. All. So, you know, tourists may come and take some photographs, but nothing else is transmitted. But if you, along with the monument, have a process of teaching so that people, they can inculcate the philosophy and the meaning of the events that took place in that area, then you have a good combination. So you need both writings and you need the monuments. Similarly, if you just had the writings, the ideas may exist, but unless they manifest practically, unless we see some physical product from those teachings, those teachings remain just simply mental concoction, as he says, a poet's fancy. Even Srila Prabhupada's own godbrothers, one of them told Srila Prabhupada, when I was there in 1976 here in Mayapur, he came to see Prabhupada the day before Gopunima, and he told Prabhupada, he said, actually this verse, Prachivichay Jaitatao Nagaradi Gram, Savatra Prachahoyabe Moranam, he said, we're thinking, you know, that this is some poetic composition. That when it said all the towns and villages in the whole world, we really actually didn't believe that. We thought that this was just some nice poetic composition to glorify the influence of the holy name. But to actually have the holy name chanted, you know, in every town and village around the world, we never even conceived of that. He said, but you've actually done it. You've actually proved. You've established the reality of this teaching. Yeah. So the two things have to be there together. He said, therefore, you are the real Acharya. So this is the business of the Acharyas, to establish the reality of the Vedic teachings, the reality of the personalities that are described there, the reality, you know, of the Leelas, what the importance of them are for us conditioned souls, because it's our way out of the material world. Amartya Sen is not going back home, back to Godhead. He's going to stay here in the material world. Gandhi is not going back home, back to Godhead. He's going to stay here in the material world, because they don't believe that there is any value in the Tirthas. Gandhi himself said, I never visit any of these places, especially the places where people go and bathe in the Ganges, because it's just a religious rip-off, basically. That there's just a lot of people there claiming to be Brahmins, and the pilgrims come and then they fleece them for as much money as they can on the basis of their religious sentiment. And I don't believe that there's any actual practical benefit from going and bathing in a river on a particular day. So that's his idea. So how will such a person go home back to Godhead? He may kick out the British from India, yeah. But he himself, what is his destination? The British may go back to India, I mean, may go back to England. But where will Gandhi go? Yeah, he's not going to go, you know, to Loka Vrindavan. He's going to stay here and take another birth somewhere according to his obsession. Yeah, if you're obsessed with something, I mean, there are some people that think that he took birth as a famous person in England. we have no proof of that, but he was meditating so much on the British, then, you know, it could well be that that was his destination. All right, now you become a Brit. But anyway, apart from that, the point is that the teachings, the Puranas are there. The fifth canto cosmology is described there. If you ask any Indian scholar, they'll tell you it's a fantasy. Yeah, this Mount Meru, Golden Mountain, and the description of Jambudweep, and, you know, Bhumandal, and the flat plains, and, you know, the sun and moon's positions. It's all, you know, some poetic composition, but it's not actually reality. So this is the difficulty, and this is what we have to overcome. As Prabhupada single-handedly pushed to establish the reality of Radha and Krishna, the reality of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the reality of their philosophy and their pastimes and the actual places, you know, like Vrindavan and others. That was what Prabhupada did when he first came back from America in 1970, at the end of August. He arrived with four sannyasis and his secretary in Calcutta, and his first business of the day was to find some place in Mayapur where he could establish a temple. And his plan was that he would establish what he used to call originally his American house in Vrindavan, another American house in Mayapur, and another one in Jagannath Puri. That was his initial aim. As things developed, then Prabhupada was able to utilize, you know, the more assistance that he was getting, the more funds that he was getting, and he expanded on those ideas. But at a minimum, he wanted Mayapur and Vrindavan, and therefore he established what was called the Mayapur Vrindavan Trust. And any money that was personally given to Srila Prabhupada, that was immediately put in the MVT account. And that MVT account was to ensure that if ISKCON collapsed, if everything else disappeared, at least there would be some funds there for the Seva Puja of the deities that he was establishing in Vrindavan and the deities that he was going to establish here in Mayapur. So Prabhupada at least that much wanted to see that the dharms, the holy dharms, were preserved, that the memory of them, the understanding of them was, you know, current in human society. And he knew that very quickly things disappear. We've seen that now, but Prabhupada also, after 1937, after the disappearance of his spiritual master, then he saw all the hard work, you know, all the cohesion, all the preaching, it just fell apart, yeah, for whatever reasons. But it happened just like that. Within a few weeks, what to even speak months or years, within a few weeks, there was fighting and arguing and disagreement, and the end result was, you know, the tremendous potency of the Gaudiya Math was lost. It was dissipated. And Prabhupada had to reestablish that. So we shouldn't think that, you know, because ISKCON is a nice, big, strong organization, and, you know, we know where Radhakund is, we know where Vrindavan is, we know where Mayapur is. Don't think that in 100 years' time that may still be the same situation. We hope. But that's our duty, that as it's been passed on from our acharyas one to another, that this the science of the transcendental relationship with the Supreme will not be nashta, it will not be lost, but it will be preserved and passed on for countless souls, millions of souls to take advantage and benefit of, and then exit this time-ruled material world and enter into the timeless spiritual world of Brajadham. This is what we're about. So we have a big responsibility. It's nice to come, as Prabhupada said, and celebrate with fruits and flowers. Yeah, he made his famous Vrindavan Bhajan poem, 59, he wrote that poem. He'd just taken sannyas, and Prabhupada wrote that long poem where he was basically berating his godbrothers that, yes, you come together, you know, for the purpose of offering some fruits and flowers for one day, and then you go away and everything is stopped. Yeah, you don't do anything for spreading the movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but you're very content just to sit in your temples, observe some festivities, go out and beg some rice and dal, and eat and sleep. But that is not the movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Prithivi Chaito Nagaradi Gram. You have to spread this message, you have to spread this knowledge all over the world to as many people as possible. That is the, because in one sense it's the secondary goal of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's appearance. The primary goal is, you know, the internal activities of, you know, his relationship, or I don't know whether you can say his relationship with Radharani. He is Radharani, or he's in the mood of Radharani, but he's Krishna. But anyway, the point is that we have this duty to preserve the reality of what we're presenting. Yeah, we shouldn't think and take it for granted that it will be so in the future. Whether we accept, you know, the theologiae principia mathematica or not, yeah, the point that he makes, whether you accept the formula that he used, John Craig, the point that he makes is very valid, that things do disappear in time. That is something that Krishna states right, you know, at the beginning of his teachings to Arjuna, that by the influence of time, this science of the relationship is lost. So therefore, I'm having to come again and again and revive it. So we accept, you know, Radha Samukha Samsaktim Saki Sangam Nivasanam. That verse describes the spiritual master as being the representative of Srimati Radharani. By Radharani's mercy, we get the mercy of Krishna. We get introduced into the Leelas. So we have to preserve a proper understanding of who Srimati Radharani is, who her representatives are, and we have to take it very seriously what they're teaching, not think that this is just, you know, some religious poetry or something. But, you know, as I made this point, even the godbrothers of Srila Prabhupada were starting to think like that after just, you know, 20 or 30 years. That this can't be true, that the holy name will go to every town and village around the world, maybe all of India. But it's a nice glorification. That means you're already on the slippery slope. Yeah, you're already on that slope of trying to quantify, what do you call it, when you reduce something down to a particular time frame. Something which is transcendental and eternal, immediately, you know, that principle of the Lord's holy name going all over the world or all over the universe is immediately reduced down to what we perceive and what we think is credible, what we think is logical, what we think is doable. But you're not talking about activities which in any way can be measured up against what we do in this material world. Yeah, we can't see the leelas of the Lord and the personalities that come with him through the prism of our own material existence. Yeah, we have a material body, it exists for a short period of time, the sun comes up, the sun goes down so many times, and then you're out. Yeah, then you go on to some other place. So we measure, we have a tendency to try to measure everything and quantify everything. Yeah, especially we like this historicity. We like to try to trace out things in a logical sequence. And that was one of the main reasons why these personalities like Amartya Sen rejected the reality of the Ramayana Mahabharata. Why? Because it's too far gone. Yeah, there's no, like in the West, let's see if I can find this. In the West, we tend to, Western scholars tend to only accept something if you can measure it in time. They want to put a date on it and a place on it, and then it's true. And therefore, there's another Western scholar, he says, with regard to history, the Hindus have done really nothing but romances from which some truth may occasionally be extracted. But Max Müller said, no wonder that a nation like India cared so little for history. They don't believe that there is like a historical tradition. Or at least the way that in India people measured events is different from the way that they do in the West. In the West they want, you know, this time, place, they want to put a label, AD so-and-so or BC so-and-so. And if they can't fit it into that, it doesn't exist. If they can't fit it into their, you know, historical sequences and dating systems, then according to them, it doesn't exist. Let's see here. Most of the Western scholars firmly believe that our ancestors grossly neglected writing history, and what we claim to be our history is nothing but therefore but mythology. M. Wintonitz, in his History of Indian Literature, this is a scholar that wrote, a Western scholar that wrote a history of Indian literature. That means all the stories about Krishna, Ram, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, whoever. He said they're nothing but mythology. Why? Because history is one weak spot in Indian literature. It is, in fact, non-existent. So they don't believe that there is such a, you know, tradition of historical records. And so when something's claimed to be, you know, a historical record, if you can't put a time and date on it, it has no value. This is their idea. They don't understand, just like with Krishna's appearance, how is it, you know, dated? Not by saying, well, this was, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years, 3,000 years before Christ or whatever. That's an arbitrary measurement. The Christians have their own calendar. The Muslims have their own calendar. The Buddhists have their own calendar. And there are so many other, Mayan calendar, this calendar, that calendar. Everybody has their own system of measuring time. And if something else, some other event, can't be fitted into their system of time, then they don't believe that it even exists. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but this is actually the situation. History is one weak spot in Indian literature. It is, in fact, non-existent. The total lack of historical sense is so characteristic that the whole course of Sanskrit literature is darkened by the defect. Why? Because you don't have some date that you can put on it. But when you point out, no, Krishna's appearance is described according to the astronomical phenomena, that at a certain point, these planets were in place, this transition was going on, this part of the constellation was at its zenith or waning or whatever it is. But it's there measured in terms of the cosmos, a much bigger, you know, it's a much broader concept for measuring time than sticking your own tiny little calendar, which, you know, in another 100 years or 1,000 years, somebody will replace with something else. The Christian calendar only really became extant in what, the 1500s, around that time? Yeah? What, the Gregorian calendar? Yeah, they wrote that. And then, because they had political influence all over the world, they enforced everybody to work according to their calendar. So, you know, we work, we think we're in the year 2014. What is that? It doesn't mean anything. It's just an arbitrary figure that they decided at a certain point we'll start counting from this particular point. Now we've come to this point, 2014. But, you know, the Buddhists don't calculate that way. Nobody else does. But they've got the dominance at the moment. So the Western scholars, they had that dominance of the you know, Christian view of the linear progression of time. But they have no conception of transcendental appearance. Yeah, it's purely spiritual appearance. They have no conception of the state of the universe beyond this tiny little planet and the small little countries that they live in. But the Bhagavatam is vast. You know, the conceptions given in the Bhagavatam, given in the Vedic literature, is way, way beyond anything that we can peg down with our tiny minds. So to give us at least some understanding, all right, if you really want to calculate when Krishna appeared, not that it's very important, because Krishna's eternal, his activities are eternal, he can manifest them at any moment, but if you still insist on measuring things according to your mundane, you know, existence, the passage of time, then here's a way to properly measure it. Yeah? Not by this calendar or that calendar, because they may be dispensed with in the future. But the planets, the movements of the planets, you're not going to dispense with them. And they move very methodically, not haphazardly. So if somebody gives you a calculation based on an astronomical configuration, you can accurately pinpoint when that was from the present time, from the way the planets are now. There are some planetary configurations that only occur once a year. There's some of configurations that only occur every 20 or 30 years. There are some configurations that only appear every couple of hundred years. And there are some configurations that only appear in thousands of years. But even though they're so distant past, seemingly, from our point of view, you can understand that it took place because there is actually a configuration. If you know the science of astronomy and the movements of the planets, you can go back, thousands, tens of thousands, 50,000, 100,000 years, and the planets were all still moving in the same exact position. So you can pinpoint and say, yes, when this configuration was extant, that's when Krishna appeared on this planet. Yeah. This is our reality, and this is our way of measuring time. But these rascals, they come in, Wintonitz, and he's writing a history of Indian literature. What is Indian literature? It's the Puranas, the Itihasas, the Vedic literature, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata. And he's writing it from his point of view that history is a weak spot. It has actually darkened the whole course of Sanskrit literature by this defect. They're all rascals. We shouldn't believe any of them, but we should accept what our acharyas have given, because they're in touch with reality. This is the point. The spiritual master is in touch with the spiritual reality of Radha and Krishna's existence. They know how to explain it. They know how to link us up and get the benefit from those histories. These are not just stories. This is life. This is who we are. That we're eternal servants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We've forgotten that, and now it needs to be revived. And that's the meaning of observing these appearance days. Yeah, no, it's a nice festival, but it affirms what we believe. It reinforces the reality of these events. We experience it directly. It's not just a mental concoction, but it's actually real in our lives. It transforms our consciousness and brings us out of this mundane plane onto the transcendental eternal platform. So in this way, then, that was one of Prabhupada's very important intentions, was to, you know, revive these places of pilgrimage, reinforce, you know, the philosophical understandings by extensive writings and, you know, explanations. Why did Prabhupada take so much time to write the Bhagavatam? The Bhagavatam was already there, but he's doing his duty to introduce it to those persons who would not normally have had any contact with it, but also to convince them of the reality of spiritual life. So he's writing and he's establishing artifacts, he's establishing places of pilgrimage. These are all very important for preserving this memory. Yeah, and then if we're Vishnu Smaranam, if we're always remembering Krishna, then our destination when we leave these tiny, you know, limited bodies, will be very, very auspicious. Prabhupada told us in New York, he said, by this Hare Krishna movement, he said, millions will be saved. So that's our duty. We have to follow the acharyas. And when we think about Radharani, it's not just some sentiment, but we should understand the deep theology behind it and the reality of her appearance and existence. Okay, so we're going to finish at this point. Does anybody have a question or a comment? I can't hear you. All right, this is from the paper in Chennai on August the 8th, 2014. August the 8th, 2014. This is in the Hindu by a staff reporter, those unknown bigamists. The Hindu says, the Ramayana and Mahabharata are epic poems. Poets have poetic license and can exaggerate. So don't take all that is mentioned in them literally. This is from Justice Markandeya Katju, the chairman of the Press Council of India. This is the propaganda. Don't take it literally. There's exaggerations. It's all figments of people's imaginations. We have to do something about this. That's what ISKCON was formed for, to establish the reality of the Puranas and our traditions. Peter Nagari Prabhu.
Yes, I just want to say that I read one very interesting article that...
There's no microphone? All right, go on.
I can speak loud.
Well, I was just thinking about the people that are listening.
There were two solar eclipses during Lord Krishna's appearance. The one in Kurukshetra and the one on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, when Shalva was being killed. And how the sky darkened and everybody thought it was night. And then Arjuna was told to kill Shalva. He was killed and then the sun came out. So there was two solar eclipses during the appearance of Lord Sri Krishna about 25 years apart. So one astrologer said, astronomer said, let's take this seriously. So he calculated when there were two solar eclipses over northern India, Kurukshetra. When was the last within a 25-year period? Yeah. When was the last time that happened? And the answer is 3,750 years before the birth of Christ.
Yes.
5,000 years ago, a little bit.
Yes, there's been some interesting studies done trying to pinpoint, you know, according to the Christian calendar, when exactly these events took place. Because if you can actually say for sure that an astronomical phenomena that's described in the Puranas actually took place, then it lends, you know, a lot of credibility and truth to it.
So figure 5,000 years ago is pretty accurate.
Yes, well, using that method, because there's been some slight disagreements, but two or three men have calculated that, you know, Krishna's appearance about Kurukshetra, that took place 3,132 BC or whatever it is. Yeah, because that actually that configuration can be there. Yes, yes, that's what they say. And even if you don't agree with exactly the, you know, calculation of the configuration compared to the calendar, at the same time, to have these descriptions in the Puranas, even if you accept the Puranas are only 1,000 or 1,500 years old, yeah, still, the fact that they had the science of astronomy then far outdates any kind of modern astronomy. Modern astronomy's only come in the last 250 or 300 years. But 1,000 years ago, the sages in India, who were apparently, you know, just simple guys living in the forest, suffering from hallucinations, they were able to accurately calculate, you know, all the different astronomical events. It's not that the solar eclipse occurred all of a sudden and nobody knew about it. They had prepared for it. They knew it was coming. Everybody was getting ready. Krishna, Balaram, Subhadra, they were in Dwarka, all the residents of Vrindavan. Everybody knew the solar eclipse is coming. We should go to Kurukshetra. So they were warned in advance. That means the science was known. That means a very advanced civilization. They could calculate all the different planetary configurations. They knew when solar or lunar eclipses were going to take place. And similarly, any auspicious time or inauspicious time, they were calculating. So how you can say that they were primitive and uncultured, even just from that point of view? Yes, I mean, there's lots of evidence there, but they choose not to see it because they make everything measure up against their own conception of reality. And if it doesn't fit in, then it must be a fairy tale. They don't think that their own existence is a fairy tale. Yeah. You may be Gandhi now, what you'll, you know, become next, that's anybody's guess. Sorry, Gyanagamya Prabhu. I can't hear you. Oh, Gyanagamya Prabhu is asking that I have these notes on my computer. Have I published them? No. A lot of this stuff I got actually from a posting. I mean, this historical stuff about the scholars and all that stuff. I got that from a posting a few weeks back on Wincom from, what's his name, Tusti Mohan Krishna. You know, he always puts stuff out. Whenever there's a special event, he compiles a lot of stuff and puts it out. So I got it from there, some of it. The other stuff I just picked up here and there. I actually can't hear a word you're saying. No, don't put your hands there, just shout. Yeah, I could publish it if I get the time to sit down and organize it. Otherwise, the video recording it, so if you want to see it again and go over it, I presume it will be on the Mayapur TV, you know, shelf there somewhere. All right, it's getting late. It's 9 o'clock. We'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.